And here we go, another week. Danny Schechter, your news dissector, back in the USSA after a month in South Africa, back on the air here at PRNFM. We have a call-in number here, 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. We're going to talk about a meeting that's taking place in South Africa called the BRICS meeting, the presidents of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are in Durban, South Africa. The question is, can they be a counterweight to the international system led by the World Bank and the IMF, Western capital? Is this an alternative, or is it something worse and something else? We'll be talking with Patrick Bond, professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, a well-known activist and academic who writes everywhere on these issues and an environmentalist to boot. And he's been monitoring this, and we're going to get a direct report from him. And then we're going to tell you a little bit about Nelson Mandela in the hospital again and his condition. Stay with us.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live and to achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die, to die, to die, to die.
Listening to Hot Sticks Mabuse, one of the great old-timers in South African music. We're going to play some more of his music. Just want to start off with some good news, or maybe good news. We don't know yet. But the most recent reports are that Nelson Mandela is responding well to treatment. He's back in the hospital. I think it's the third time in 4 months with a infection, respiratory problem, going back to contracting TB when he was in prison. So the latest word seems to be that he's responding. We'll see what happens. He is 94 years old, but at least some good news or some hope to start off with. Patrick Bond with us from KwaZulu-Natal, one of the provinces of South Africa, the university there. He works with all the different civic groups and civil society organizations, and he's been monitoring and talking about this BRICS meeting in South Africa. Could you give us a little background for the folks who haven't been following what its significance is and what your take on it is?
Well, first, Danny, it's so good to be back with you. We didn't see enough of each other in your month-long work here on the Mandela movie and the making of the Mandela movie. It's going to be terrifically important, especially given Madiba's ill health, to keep the extraordinary repertoire of material that you draw back from so many years of work. I think you were first in Durban here in 1967, I believe you told Albert Luthuli's funeral. Is that right? And it was an extraordinary time.
On this point, Patrick, I was what was called a London recruit, recruited to go underground into South Africa to fight, be part of the secret war against apartheid, then at a time of repression, intense repression under apartheid. Mandela was starting his sentence. He had just been in prison for just a few years, and the ANC was trying to fight back, and it couldn't get its own people into South Africa. So I was there. And then I left South Africa last Thursday, went to London, and in London on Friday night at the London School of Economics, we had a reunion of these London recruits. None of us knew each other because of secrecy and compartmentalization. Nobody knew who the other people were, but we met at the London School of Economics for a really rousing discussion of the struggle against apartheid in the old days and the continuing struggle for economic justice in South Africa today. So this is something I've been part of for many, many years. Nelson Mandela said, the struggle is my life. And for both of us, I think it is ours as well. So, Patrick, talk to us about BRICS and what's going on there.
Well, great. And again, you're always welcome here in Durban. People really know you and love you. And that extends from those deep in the ANC to those who've left the ANC. I'm one of those who got a bit frustrated. I think the main point here is this ruling party, the African National Congress, is very proud that the president, Jacob Zuma, has joined four very big emerging markets. Of course, BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa was added in 2010. And this is the first hosting opportunity. Next year, it'll be back starting the alphabet again in Brazil. And these five heads of state were here Tuesday, Wednesday. They actually left early this morning, and they did some deals. And we should talk about some of them, Danny, because they don't necessarily bode well for the economy, and especially the environment.
I mean, let's just tell people who was there. Vladimir Putin was there. The new president of China was there. The president of India was there. Dilma, the president of Brazil was there. And Jacob Zuma was sort of thrown in as an afterthought, but he was there as well. So these are some, you know, powerful people on the surface appearing to offer an alternative to the global financial system, which is dominated really by the United States and the West. And now suddenly these so-called emerging countries are saying, no, we want to have our own say in development policy and strategy and the rest. But that's what it looks like on the surface. But is that what it really is?
Well, let's get to the devil in the details on the particular questions of whether world finance can be reformed and some of the other strategies that the emerging markets have to get that greater influence. I think I should say, for Xi Jinping, the new Chinese premier, he started in Tanzania a few days ago, then he came to Durban, and the major deals really reflect an extraordinary amount of money in China that doesn't have anywhere else to go. I hate to tell you, Danny, but your tea bills are not really worth that much over the long term, and the Chinese have been, in a very subtle way, disinvesting from the U.S., even though they need the U.S. market. They need to keep funding the United States so that the U.S. will buy those cheap goods from China. It's this awful deathlock that China and the U.S. are in. But there's a lot of extra money, and that has to go somewhere. Here's the plan, Danny. It was to get $50 billion together to start a new bank that was, as you say, on the surface, allegedly a rival to the World Bank. And it would be a bank with a focus on infrastructure. And here was meant to be the launch site of the bank because Africa is open for business. Africa is rising, and South Africa is the gateway. That's all the official rhetoric, and it all ended in a veil of tears because, unfortunately, for the BRICS leaders, they couldn't come to grips with their own internal contestations. We could go into a variety of them. The UN Security Council is one where Russia, China, they have a permanent membership along with some of the others from Europe and, of course, the US, but they couldn't agree over the last period to let in India or South Africa or Brazil to the UN Security Council as permanent members. That, another example, Danny, is last year the World Bank presidency came open. Robert Zoellick, the former militarist from the Bush regime, was being replaced. And before, Barack Obama had appointed Jim Yong Kim, it was quite a race. And there was a Nigerian finance minister, total neoliberal. Everyone in Nigeria hated her, had an Occupy Nigeria that nearly overthrew the country. That was South Africa's choice. The Brazilians chose a progressive development economist, Jose Antonio Ocampo. And the Russians actually went with the ultimate winner, Jim Yong Kim, the U.S. choice, a U.S. citizen of Korean origin who was Dartmouth president. And it's just interesting to see that I'm trying to drive home a point that although it appears there's a new emerging market bloc, it's incoherent and it's not able to actually put forth positions on global governance properly. And we'll come, I hope, to the question of the climate, one of the big, big ones. But I would like to say first, though, this apparent challenge on the financial side could go somewhere if the world economy continues its melt, if like a Cyprus, which went belly up a few days ago, becomes contagious, and next it spreads to some of the other weaker European states, and they decide to do what Cyprus did, which is basically to declare a default and to put exchange controls to keep rich people's money inside the country.
Not just the default. I mean, they're actually confiscating people's money, aren't they? I mean, isn't that part of it?
And, of course, the big challenge is whether poor and working people can keep 100% of their pitiful life savings in a place like Cyprus, and whether the Russian oligarchs, some of the big investors, are able to get their money out. And that's the class struggle within Cyprus that remains. But here's the point, that this contestation of global finance is in play. And unfortunately, we have expectations that the BRICS might challenge imperialism, financial imperialism. The World Bank and IMF, the Bank for International Settlements, which is the big central bank for the central bankers. And, of course, then it's the U.S. Fed that throws the money in, now the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England. Those are the major actors out there. And the question is, can a new BRICS bank come up with an alternative approach that combines development finance plus a new currency plus a new reserve system, those three functions? It sounds technical and complicated, Danny. You know this as well as anyone, given your work on protecting consumers from financial predation. But let's boil it down to a big challenge. Will a $50 billion bank get started up to challenge the World Bank?
So what was decided?
No, because the Russians sabotaged it yesterday. And it seemed to be a function of their coming in a bit late in the game. They're not having a lot of experience and profile in global finance. They've only got a little export-import bank that was part of the design team. And our finance minister here in South Africa, named Pravin Gordhan, I'm sure you've known him over the years, quite a great activist. He once taught me sort of Marxist revolutionary theory out in Gandhi's old settlement in Phoenix. And Pravin Gordhan actually had made announcements, so had some of the international relations, the foreign policy, the foreign ministry people, saying we were going to get that bank here in South Africa with its headquarters, and it would be that magic 50 billion number. Now, Danny, I'm already hearing you ask me, why 50? And the answer is Joe Stiglitz from New York and from London, Nick Stern. These are two of the sort of former World Bank chief economists. Stiglitz gone a little bit further to the left. And they said to the BRICS leaders last year, 50 billion is a good number if you want to start a bank. So that would be a bank that would finance infrastructure. And here's the rub. Africa needs money for infrastructure. And yet Africa is being massively looted for its petroleum and its raw materials.
So that's an interesting. Let's just underscore this for people who, you know, you're in South Africa and you think globally, you're involved in global movements. So people in America think about the United States. They don't always think about globalization and the impact it's had or how American policy impacts on people in other countries and affects what's possible in other countries and intervenes to stop progressive measures. So here's a situation where it seemed on the surface to be a promising development. On the other hand, it has this dual character, as you point out. On the one hand, it could make a contribution to vital needs in Africa. On the other hand, many of the powers in this formulation have their own interests at stake, and they are, you know, kind of gobbling up African resources. It's almost like
That's exactly the right way. You know, the first gobbling, what they called it, the scramble for Africa, was 1885. When in Berlin, five big colonial powers, a couple of smaller ones, but the five big ones being the host Germany and Belgium and Britain, of course, and then France and Portugal, carved this continent into bizarre spaces that are now the countries, the 53 countries of Africa. Those country borders were set by flipping coins. I'm not joking, Danny. They actually occasionally had to dispute a mountain here or a river there. And the objective of that meeting in 1885 was to carve up Africa so that a more efficient system of extracting the plantation outputs and the mining outputs through roads, railways, bridges, on the way to the ports, could be established with laws and contracts and armies and colonies. And this was 1885 Berlin. There was a huge amount of wealth understood to be in Africa at that point, because in 1867 in Kimberley, the biggest diamond fields were found.
That's in South Africa, Kimberley in South Africa.
That's right. Yeah. And so these are the sort of precedents for which a new five come now to Durban in 2013. And the question is whether, like Berlin in 1885, ordinary people simply get dispossessed in the process.
Now, of course, Patrick, when you raise this parallel, this freaked out a lot of these countries. They denied it up and down. This is absolutely ridiculous. We're not imperialists. We're here to help. And that was their position. Now, in light of this meeting, what would be your assessment of the impact?
Well, the meeting didn't do what it wanted, which was to put this bank together, announce it, and get it up and running in South Africa. The precedent here is something called the Development Bank of Southern Africa, and it's in a very sorry state of affairs. It lost about $40 million in its investments last year, including, I might say, in the mining sector, where we had a massacre, as you know, in August last year, 34 miners killed. The investigations and the commission into this are underway this week, and the police chief has been under cross-examination by none other than George Bezos, Mandela's main lawyer during the old days, and he's 84 and he's just powering away and really humiliating Ria Payeha, the new police commissioner. And at the same time, just on Saturday last week, South Africa had 13 of its troops that were doing peacekeeping, really trying to defend the autocrat in charge of the Central African Republic, whose name is François Bozizé, and trying to defend his may I say, illegitimate and authoritarian rule in a country rich with minerals and oil.
And rich with poor people. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. If you recall, that's the country they tried to send President Aristide of Haiti to. And I think they were going to knock him off. And at that point, I think Thabo Mbeki, to his credit, invited Aristide to come to South Africa. But, this is a situation where the South African military was sent to serve this despotic leader. And there was a rebellion there, military rebellion, it seems, a coup. And how many South Africans were killed?
Well, we know of 13 and 27 wounded, but even worse, Danny, this is a coup in which the first line of fire against the South Africans were by the very people the South African National Defense Force was training. So the soldiers shot the men that they were being trained by, according to reliable sources in the trade union of the army. Now, the second factor is if Bozizé was worth saving, and this was some sort of attempt to prevent an illegitimate coup, you can really tell how awful Bozizé was by the fact that the French didn't try to save him. The French stood by as this coup unfolded. Now, when the French don't go into that for one of their pocket dictators, this pocket dictator has no future.
This sounds a little like Afghanistan, where the troops the United States has been training have turned, on what's a green on blue or whatever they call it, have turned on American soldiers. There was just another incident last week of Afghan military attacking American soldiers. So,
indeed, reminds you of probably Vietnam back in the day when U.S. soldiers shot their own officers. Now, there's a tragedy here, right? These are all, by the way, low-income African bodies coming back. They're the grunts. These are the victims of the incredibly high unemployment rate, probably around 40% when you count everyone who's given up looking. So this is a classic kind of tragedy of poor young lads that are going up there to fight against rebels. And the rebels, I don't know much about what their ideological orientation and their social base is, but certainly they threaten not just Bozizé, the dictator, but they threaten mineral deals. And those are now beginning to unravel that South Africans were doing all kinds of deals. And that's what was the basis for, in January, sending in those troops to their deaths.
There's a lot of talk of peace in Africa, but what it really means is a piece of Africa. That's what happened. I was in the DRC, Democratic Republic of the Congo, a country that's been plagued by war ever since the 60s. And again, even neighboring countries that came in to rescue the Congo were trying to rescue the minerals in the Congo for themselves. So it's a really complicated and, criminal looting that's been taking place there, and the people themselves, some of the people I met, they have maybe one meal every few days. It's extremely poor. afflicted with all kinds of disease and everything else. And while these various kleptocrats do well, and this is one of the shocking things that's going on, one of the legacies of the CIA murdering Lumumba in the Congo back when I was in college in 1961. So, you know, there's a historical dimension to all of this, which often is lost in the media, and there's no memory there of what happened. And of course, even going back further to 1884, to the Leopold's, you know, invasion and intervention and brutal, you know, domination of the people of the Congo. So this all has a history of, you know, colonialism, of massacres, of brutality on a scale that most of us couldn't even imagine. Arms being cut off, people being chopped to death, and the rest of it.
Well, the scale, you're right, Danny, because 5 million people are known to have died in the DRC, in the eastern part, where coltan is mined, along with a lot of other minerals.
Let's tell people what coltan is, if they don't know.
Well, I don't have one of those smartphones because I live in a fairly unsophisticated way. Tell us about it.
It's used in the making of smartphones, that are all the rage, you know, right now, Samsung versus Apple, blah, blah, blah. But they all use this mined coltan, and it's contributing to the deaths of people in the Congo without any real much of an investigation going on in our media. So it's something that really requires some thinking and some conscience and some consciousness. And this is a problem that we have here because we're consumers. You know, Apple announces a new phone and people are lining up in the streets to get it, even though there's no real improvement on the old phone. They have to have the new model. And Apple makes sure by changing the plugs that you can't use the old plugs in the new phone. So you have to get the new phone. It's a frenzy computer, you know, addiction. And also, you know, it's like I wrote a recent article about the malls in South Africa, you know, talked about the sheeple, you know, instead of the people who are shopping there, paying much more than they would be able to buy things at in other places, you know, for the safety or security or the, you know, the restaurants or whatever in these vast malls in your country, which are, you know, kind of an imitation of malls in our country.
Well, that's quite right. And it boils down to the Western mode of consumer-based economics, massively funded through debt, consumer credit, as you saw here, just like the subprime problem you've investigated. It's out of control. But I think if we go back to what the BRICS represent, the resource curse comes up. If you go to a wonderful popular film, thestoryofelectronics.org, all of the critique you've just provided of how the ad man gets into our head and doesn't allow us to connect the dots the way you're doing, back to the resources like the coltan and all the other minerals that go into so many of ordinary Western products. If you do that, you'll see that kleptocrats and tyrants like Bozizé, or in Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, who's now presiding over the largest diamond extraction in a place called Morangi, hand in hand with the Chinese company Anjin and the generals in the junta there. These are the kinds of resource curses that we're finding. Platinum in South Africa gives us another example. In the e-zines that I write for occasionally, Znet and the Counterpunch, you can find my analysis with my co-author Khadija Sharif about this problem now. And we've in a sense found the BRICS ready to step in to amplify it. And that's really the essence of the infrastructure investment. And when your listeners, Danny, hear the two words Africa rising because of the commodity price increases since 2002, in a sense, justifying more of the extraction because GDP is going up, they're forgetting that when the GDP goes up because of extraction, something's coming out, minerals that don't grow back. And that means that the overall wealth of the society isn't just an income increase, the GDP, the gross domestic product, but if you count it properly, you have to count the decrease in your natural wealth, the assets, some call it natural capital. And when you do that, Africa is not rising. The resource curse means Africa is shrinking. Even the World Bank admits 6% per year. And this is the kind of, let me call it a reality check, that the BRICS is preventing us from understanding because there's so much hype about development.
When I was in Durban, you know, and began looking into the economy and the economic crisis, and found that poverty is deeper now than it was in 1994 when the ANC came to power after a struggle that went on forever, and that the income inequality in South Africa has always been bad. Now we have it as almost as bad here, you know, where you know, I just read a report, Patrick, that said that over the last 20 years, people who have increased their assets have increased it by an average of $59, okay? And in other words, the redistribution that's really needed of wealth and is not happening. Instead, we have these, you know, 1% billionaires who are just, you know, acquiring more, controlling more, while the people are losing everything. We have in this week in America, big battle in Chicago where they're closing schools left and right. My own high school in the Bronx faced closure. So this is something that affects us too, folks. This is not just a problem for people in Africa. This is a problem that we have to look at in a global way. And, you know, it's linked in some ways to environmental issues, which I'd like to raise with you, Patrick, when we come back. We have to take a little break now, and to try to look closely at what's happening to the environment and the climate, because this wasn't discussed. It was buried here in the United States by and large until Sandy, the storm, hit us, and suddenly the mayor of New York was a born-again environmentalist. But we still haven't seen any serious measures adopted in connection with this. So stay with us here. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. I'm back on the air on PRN FM. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute. A little more music now from Sipo, Hot Sticks, Mabuse.
Nelson Mandela began serving a life sentence in South Africa's Robben Island prison. Many of the anti-apartheid activists were also in prison or in exile. The movement was leaderless until South Africa's children rose up to galvanize the struggle once again. Here is part three of Mandela, an audio history.
This is the site of South Africa's top security jail, Robben Island, a narrow pencil of land off Cape Town, 7 miles out in the South Atlantic. These watchtowers stand guard over men who millions of black South Africans regard as their government in exile.
We landed at Robben Island. There's big iron gates. And every gate bangs behind me. And then the warder opened one of the doors of the cell, wooden doors, then he opened the grill, and he just shoved me. And there was my bucket and a couple of blankets. And that was my first night.
We worked at the lime quarry. We'd never done pick and shovel work before. So every day we had bleeding hands and blisters. It's very, very hot. When we started working there, we were told that we'd work there for 6 months. We in fact worked there for about 13 years.
In the lime quarry, most of the time you're leaning on your shovel or your pickaxe. But all of the time you're in a group of people discussing things.
I mean, every single man on the island was a book, so to speak, and you could really learn from each one of them.
Well, that's from a program called Mandela, an Audio History, that was Archbishop, former Archbishop Desmond Tutu, introducing it. A little taste of Robben Island, the prison that I've been to. I made a film there in 1995 called Prisoners of Hope. It was a reunion of the men who served on that island and who survived a brutal incarceration that went on and on and on and on. And among them, of course, was Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela emerged from the island and his experience and went from being a prisoner to being the president of South Africa. Now fast forward 22 years or whatever, and here we are still dealing with many of the issues that he was dealing with then. Joining me from South Africa is Patrick Bond, professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal is on the east coast of South Africa. It's a beautiful, beautiful area known as a home of Zulu people and of many of South Africa's Indian community and many whites as well. It's a place that I just spent a month in. Patrick Bond has been teaching there for many years and is very widely known and well-respected for his work as an advocate for social change, an advocate for doing something about the climate. And there was a big conference in Durban some years ago, COPS, the environmental conference, which didn't seem to achieve very much. So what is your prognosis now about the climate issue, which is not just something that's abstract, because it's something that can have affected us here in New York City, and it can affect a lot of people in Africa, all along the coast there?
Well, indeed, it's probably Africans that will be hardest hit. The estimates are 200 million deaths unnecessarily this century in Africa. And this is, of course, not only the small island states of the Pacific sinking and whole nations dying out as a result of having to move, or the Himalayas, the great water tower of Asia, drying up after the huge deluge that can be expected when the glaciers melt. The same for the Andes. Terrible damage that will already costing 400,000 lives a year, according to some of the scientific estimates. And so it's a crisis. Sandy hit you very hard, I know there. Danny, I know your stories of the difficulties, and I know how Occupy Sandy inspired people. I believe the price tag was $60 billion that Barack Obama put to the Congress. Just think about this happening in a much bigger way, a third of Pakistan being underwater. And we had at our big Bricks from Below meeting of an alternative civil society, we had as our last panelists the local Pan-African Justice Alliance leadership and Bill McKibben, who Skyped in from Vermont. And he had a really great set of arguments for us about how the next stage of the struggle is against the fossil fuel industries. Here in South Africa, the struggle is against the government here and the big fossil fuel, especially here in South Durban, the largest refinery complex in Africa, as well as the largest single CO2 emission site in the world, which is Sasol. It's a company that has a little city, which it's entirely devoted to taking coal and now gas and squeezing it to make liquid petroleum. So this is the context, right? And the COP17, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, Conference of the Parties, 17, that's the big UN climate summit. For short, everyone just called it Conference of Polluters. But that COP17 was here in Durban. That was in December 2011. And if you go back even 2 years earlier, this is where the BRICS come in again. The deal that was done by Barack Obama, just after he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and I guess I note that Bradley Manning's been nominated. There's a petition that I signed a short while ago. But that Nobel Peace Prize empowered Obama to come down from Norway and go to the Copenhagen Climate Summit. And in that summit, he took aside four other leaders. That was Wen Jiabao, the Chinese premier, and it was Jacob Zuma, our current president of South Africa. It was Lula, the Brazilian president at the time. He's been replaced. And then Manmohan Singh, the Indian prime minister, still the prime minister. And those five men agreed to destroy the United Nations collective process that was attempting to develop a next stage of the Kyoto Protocol. What it means is that, as Bill McKibben put it, they wrecked the United Nations. So just take that as your context, Danny. That's that Barack Obama and any Washington bureaucrat Todd Stern's the leader, but Hillary Clinton was also there. Their intent is to sabotage these global negotiations because of the strength of the fossil fuel industry, its purchase of the U.S. Congress.
So they function as an extension of these vested interests who are lobbying them and who are helping to finance their campaigns, and they act directly counter to the all the organizations around the world that are trying to save the planet, that are trying to institute progressive measures to save lives and to stop this disaster which is on the way. And these liberal, so-called liberal politicians, are actually up front doing all this without, you know, many people in our country even aware of it. I mean, we just had a presidential election where climate change was not even an issue.
Wasn't mentioned until Sandy, luckily for Obama, allowed him to say he's got a slightly better position, and hence that did play into his reelection, I gather. So then you've got the other four. So it's not just the sort of United States always wrecking some multilateral process that would improve the world, but the other four also came to the table. Those are the other BRICS, with the exception of Russia. And those guys also have big fossil fuel industries. South Africa is probably the most dominant with our huge coal reserves. The cheapest electricity in the world goes to the biggest mining house in the world here. The profits go back to Melbourne, Australia, where BHP Billiton is headquartered. And if you get that kind of configuration of power, you're not going to find someone like Jacob Zuma going to Copenhagen or hosting the Durban COP17 and actually trying to solve the problem. They're basically trying to defend the interests of those powerful corporations, which keep a sort of revolving door, a captive regulatory system with the state, a crony capitalism that's gotten out of control. Actually, Danny, I was thinking the way you were describing the vested interests, the profound corruption of the U.S. Congress. And it's reflected back here in South Africa in even more explicit ways, an arms deal in which President Zuma has been implicated. And he's, in fact, with the new BRICS Bank coming up, all of these processes will be amplified, and Zuma's even hand-chosen some of the key people to run this from the South African side. One was the brother of the man who was the go-between on the arms deal corruption with the German British arms dealers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's important to recognize that where you have corruption, you need a corrupter, okay? Corruption is a two-way process, and a lot of the people who point the finger at corruption in South Africa, correctly, by the way, corrupt politicians and the like, do not similarly point the finger at corrupt corporations that offer the bribes, that also make the deals, that, in you know, so there's a process that's global in its approach. And one of the things, when I was in South Africa my last week there, I read that South Africa is talking about going nuclear with nuclear power plants. What's that about?
Well, that was another part of yesterday's announcements at the end of the official meeting of BRICS. They did stay on and they met 15 heads of state and they left this morning. But one of the set of announcements was that Russian nuclear technology would be brought to South Africa. People said, what, Chernobyl? We don't need that secondhand stuff that's going to blow up. But indeed, as the rest of the world or civilized societies like Germany begin that transition from the nuclear to post-nuclear, hopefully also post-coal. Unfortunately, the corrupt relationships that we feel are embodied in BRICS and many of, well, at least the Chinese and the Russian leadership are profoundly repressive leaderships, and the inability of civil society to even talk openly in a place like China reflects this. So it's a real big challenge that a lot of negative things are coming through when you look at the devil in the details. Many more examples, Danny. The big railroad loan that was announced yesterday, about $5 billion. We definitely need better railroads in this country, better public transport, especially in the cities as well as out to the rural areas. That's where our national rail company, it's called Transnet, has fallen apart. They just got a $5 billion loan yesterday from the Chinese, but it's not to fix railroads for ordinary people or for commerce. It's really for coal, the export of coal from two of the further provinces up in the northern part of the country, Limpopo and Mpumalanga. And so we're going to see, again, a massive extraction process of fossil fuels. Another example, just a couple of kilometers from where I'm talking to you, on the bluff in South Durban, as I said, we've got the biggest refinery complex. It's also the biggest port in Africa, and they're expanding that from about 2.5 million containers a year to 20 million, again, with the BRICS project being quite central to that. And that's why the Civil Society Alternative Group said we're going to have to try to draw the line. And South Durban was one of the host sites to have visitors from all over the BRICS and the hinterlands join activists to say that BRICS from below would oppose BRICS from above. And I think that's the spirit in this country. You've seen it again and again, fighting apartheid.
Yeah, one of the things that impresses me is, you know, you do tours for people to actually see the reality of people's lives. It's not just a tour of, you know, tourist sites. It's a tour of how people are living and of the industrial concentration and who owns what and all the rest of it. Also, in Durban, you know, you've been writing a regular column in the mainstream media there, in a big newspaper every week. But, you know, it's certainly not the dominant view. It's a kind of a dissenting view. Why is it, do you think, that people who have heard about all this for so many years are sort of paralyzed about doing something about it, including the people in the ANC who you know, fought for a better life for all? Where are they? What's happened to the consciousness of all these activists?
Well, I think a great many of them have begun to become so turned off by the ANC, they're dropping out. And the question is, would they find an alternative project, especially in civil society, since there's no left party of any sort? And the question is whether these extraordinary divisions that are opening up, they really opened up last August when the massacre at Marikana happened. Danny, as you know, the trade union movement more or less split in two, communists who are rather conservative in this context, siding with the government, new independent trade unions emerging, taking over huge numbers of the members of the old unions, and then community groups, civic groups, environmental groups split in all sorts of ways. So we definitely have a high rate of protest, but it's, in fact, I think it's the highest in the world per person, according to what I've been able to check of the statistics, about 10,000 a year.
They say that South Africa and China share the largest number of protests at the community grassroots level against policies. So
the police tell us, yes. And I think the reason is the extraordinary squeeze of neoliberalism and, as you mentioned earlier, worsening inequality. Since 1994, that measure of inequality, the Gini, has gone up. And that's really a shocking revelation. And it did. When I was working in Mandela's office, plenty of policies were adopted that are directly causing this rise in inequality. So these are big, big structural problems, and even under Mandela's rule, an African National Congress that was too quickly co-opted by big business and to do its way into excessively globalized. And it comes back then to who's opposing and how. And I don't think it really will come from inside the ANC. I think probably a split and the trade unions ultimately having to leave and set up some sort of workers' party. That's the future, I suspect, maybe 5 or 8 years. But in the meantime, there are occasional victories. And Danny, you saw in Durban, this was the core of the AIDS pandemic, where we've had probably 700,000 of our residents in Durban HIV positive, the highest number of any city in the world. And it's where the movement to get free medicines that used to cost $10,000 a year a decade ago now became so successful after defeating the U.S. government, the South African government, the trade-related intellectual property system of the World Trade Organization, and big pharma corps, and the whole idea intellectual property to get generic medicines that are more or less free. 1.8 million South Africans now get these medicines for free. That's the sort of victory led by a treatment action campaign, very charismatic people like Zaki Ahmed, who were able to contest. At that point, it was Thabo Mbeki, but even Mandela hadn't come on board the struggle against AIDS until after he left office in 1999. Then he became quite a strong ally. And I think those are the lessons that encourage many of us who are so distraught by a revolution that has been so soured. And especially when in a time like BRICS, Danny, this is the moment when the anti-imperialist rhetoric is at its strongest. I think you probably remember the slogan that's sometimes used to describe this problem. It's called top left, walk right. In other words, there's a rhetorical nationalism, and even explicit, the phrase anti-imperialism is used by President Zuma on the one hand. But on the other hand, a few days later, this was in January, he went to Davos, the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, and said to the biggest businesses in the world, South Africa's open, come on in. And this is really what BRICS has been doing, more or less giving up on Western governments and aid that had been promised in Glen Eagles at the G8 meeting 2005, or in the New Partnership for Africa's Development, and now looking for this huge amount of money that should flow into a BRICS bank. And then the next obvious question, well, it's a bank. It needs to be repaid with interest. Who's going to be paying if it's extremely expensive to put infrastructure into Africa? You can loot the continent, get the money back that way. But if you want to put in a water system or a sanitation system or an electricity system or a road, how will you squeeze poor people to get the return on investment? And that's the unanswered question, and mostly unasked question. And that's why I think the BRICS Bank has, fortunately for many of us who are expecting a real fast track, it's actually been slowed down by Russia, as they probably want to grapple with whether by controlling the G20 this year, they're the chair, they can maybe grab hold of it. And they've announced that, and it was a bit of a surprise to everyone, that there wouldn't be a BRICS bank. It'll have to wait until the Russians figure out what they want to do when they announce it at the G20 meeting, the finance ministers meeting.
Again, we see superpower domination. You know, on issues that are really life and death issues for ordinary people. And you have decisions being made in Moscow or Washington or Beijing, and really removing them from the people's ability to influence what's going on in this sort of globalized world of ours. And that's why I was really impressed when I came to one of your classes and I met some students there from other parts of Africa who are describing what they're going through in their countries and why these issues, why they have made common cause with others to fight for economic justice. This is an issue that's extremely important. And, you know, when you look at the ANC's experience, of course, it's a great disappointment for many in the anti-apartheid movement and many people who struggled in South Africa and for South Africa to see what's happened there. And, you know, in part it's because of the intervention of powerful corporate forces that have basically dominated the whole process and imposed the kind of neoliberal agenda, which really frustrates democracy at every turn and imposes big power solutions. And this is something I know that you have been leading the fight against. At this point, are you pessimistic, optimistic? Do you see a possibility of turning all this around?
Well, I've been leading from the academic armchair, you, Danny. You know, I'm just a writer. I'm a librarian and documenting what's going on. Let me give you an example of hope, because probably last year you would have met a man called Farai Maguwu. And Farai is one of our PhD students, and he's responsible for watchdogging in Zimbabwe in a place called Mutare on the eastern side of Zimbabwe, the biggest diamond find ever. It's at the Morangi diamond fields. And he's been tortured, put in jail for 5 weeks, prevented from going out into the world to testify by Mugabe. But not only Mugabe's generals, who don't want the relationships with China to be unveiled and the billions of dollars they've already sucked out, a tiny pittance of which has returned to the Zimbabwean treasury. They don't want that to be disrupted. But more to the point, it's a Chinese company. And there's a South African named Abi Chikane who was responsible for Farai Maguwu going to jail by setting him up. And Abi Chikane, brother of Frank Chikane, I'm sure you remember, great theologian. Abi's a diamond dealer, and he's the South African in charge of the Kimberley process. South Africa's about to take over the Kimberley process. Your listeners may remember the film Blood Diamonds. And the Kimberley process was meant to take what for De Beers was a huge problem, the big De Beers monopoly on diamonds, huge overproduction, and to say, well, some of these diamonds are blood diamonds, don't buy them, and try to get some responsibility. You can track the origins of a diamond. If it's from Sierra Leone, don't buy it. That was the story 10 years ago. Now, the question is, should Zimbabwe be put on that list? Farai Maguwu thinks yes, because these are not blood diamonds alone, but they're also resource cursed diamonds, because the money's going to China, going to Israel for the cutting, going to India for the polishing, all kinds of places that never flow back to the poor Zimbabweans. And it's at that point that the U.S., having chaired the Kimberley process, showed it was also in league and has allowed South Africa to take over this year. The 10th anniversary is next month in Johannesburg. It'll be one of those other sites for an alternative civil society conference to try to unveil this resource curse and how it implicates corporations, West and East, governments, West and East, including apartheid Israel, as well as the whole complex of which diamonds are pulled out of the earth and ordinary Zimbabweans get nothing, and the environment out in eastern Zimbabwe, a place I've lived on and off for 20 years, beautiful place, has been wrecked. The water system's destroyed by the utterly insensitive mining operations that the Chinese have been running. So these are really important moments to say, what's going on? Are BRICS an alternative, an anti-imperialist project? Or, Danny, to us it looks like, no, they're not against, they're within, they're a sub-imperialist project.
And so as this happens, of course, very little of this comes through in our media. I did send you, Patrick, an article that was in Reuters that at least referenced the critique that's being made of BRICS and the BRICS from below activism that's taken place in Durban. And you know, I think that this is clearly a set of issues that will be with us for many years to come because, you know, it's increasingly obvious that resources are not flowing to the people who need them the most. Inequality is deepening. Poverty is growing. And this country as well. And so we have a situation where it's necessary for people to hook up with each other across borders, across boundaries, to try to learn from each other as well. And I think your role in all of this has been really important, Patrick, in bringing these issues to the public. Your work is on ZNet often. Your work is on many other outlets. A friend of yours referred to you as a production machine, a writing machine, getting these ideas out. You're a great teacher and an inspiration, and I'm so happy that you could join us on Progressive Radio Network and fill us in on these issues that are not only of interest in Africa, but interest in the rest of the world. So thank you very much for being with us.
Danny, thanks. Last little advert, if your listeners can check for African news, pambazooka.org, a nonprofit, 500,000 Africans are reading it each week. That's really where I think you'll find the hope and you'll find the coverage that you might not be getting in the mainstream. But it's great to be with you. Thank you so much indeed.
And just to advise everyone, mediachannel.org is back. Mediachannel.org is a leading website monitoring the media. As the media watch the world, we watch the media. I invite you to join us there. My blog is at newsdissector.net. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I welcome your comments and suggestions for future programs. Polarity One, Polar Levine will be with us again next week. Thank you for tuning in. We're going to go out with a little more music from Sipo, Hot Sticks, Mabuse.